start that. I didn't need correcting.
Shut up! Order!
Order! Let's start off as we need to go on.
We can see a better future.
So it's not a competition who can shout the loudest.
Hello and welcome to the Left Wingers podcast. I'm Brandon.
I'm Kathleen.
And I'm Amy.
Amy, it's great to have you with us. Please introduce yourself. Tell the Left Wingers a little bit about you and what role you got elected to last week.
Yeah, so I'm Amy. I'm chair of the Young Fabian Education Network and was elected on Friday to the Young Fabian National Exec, which is very exciting.
Thank you for joining us, Amy. It's wonderful to have you. It's always great to have a chat with you. And actually, before we started this recording, we had a very lengthy conversation anyway. So I hope that by the end of the recording, we're not out of energy. But we'll see how we do. We'll see how we go. So we're going to get straight into it. Probably the biggest piece of news in the last week. Rishi Sunak's autumn budget. What it means for ordinary working people. What it means for the economy as a whole. I think it raises a lot of big questions about the government's plans for how to manage the economy going into the future. And there's some fairly big announcements in there, although I'm not entirely convinced by the media's presentation of it as kind of a spending spree. I thought that was quite an unusual way of reporting on it, because there were promises in there which I didn't expect, but I wouldn't exactly say that it was the Conservatives dropping the kind of fiscally, well, conservative agenda. I didn't see that, to be honest. Although it is significant in that they actually increased real spending across all government departments, which is something that hasn't happened since 2010, which, you know, it is a bit of a break, but the funding's not increased too much. Do you have any thoughts and feelings about the budget? Did you watch it? I didn't watch Rishi Sunak, but I listened to the Labour response afterwards and then just listened to the summary of Rishi Sunak.
You kind of summarised that quite well. So I think there's several points to make here. I think it wasn't a typical Conservative budget. I thought it was very optimistic. And I have some questions about it. I think it was the best case scenarios type of budget. And I think if we're looking at a bad winter, I think the next budget will not be so nice. I didn't quite understand why they've cut tax on internal domestic flights. I thought that was quite strange, because COP26 is literally last weekend. And I think on the whole, I mean, I think a lot of the budget rests on the fact, or a lot of thinking behind the budget rests on the fact that inflation will stay as it is. And I don't think in the next kind of financial year that will be the case. I also thought it was quite interesting, obviously, Keir, 10 minutes before PMQ's announced on social media that he had COVID, he had come into contact with someone who had COVID, but that he and that he himself had the virus. So I thought the response from Rachel Reeves was not terrible, considering Ed Miliband was not terrible, considering they had little time to prepare for it.
Yeah, so I caught like parts of it. I was sort of at work at the same time, but I did catch sort of bits of it. I caught the bit about cutting the duty for domestic flights, which I thought was insane, given that it was like a week to COP, and it would have been a really good time to have cut rail fares. So I thought it was really bizarre that they were cutting passenger duty for domestic flights, and that they said that the people who fly the further should pay more, and people who fly sort of like the shortest distances should pay less, when actually I think you should be sort of penalised for flying really short distances. It just seemed completely wrong priorities in terms of that. The return of funding per pupil to like the 2010 levels was not great. You know, it's been quite a while since 2010. That's not really what we should be aiming for. But yeah, it wasn't like the worst budget ever, but I think it did kind of highlight where their priorities were. We've had like a lot of like Labour kind of graphics come out, sort of like cutting tax on champagne. And I think it's kind of annoying, because it's like an easy way to get a lot of like popular support by cutting tax on alcohol, and people are like, oh my god, they're actually like trying to help us. But it's like, you save 3p a pint, it's not this amazing like saving that we're all gonna be making.
Yeah, it won't necessarily matter for consumers. It's more of a kind of incentive to businesses, I think, because I don't doubt that in Wetherspoons, Rishi Sunak might be plastered over the magazines again. I feel like that's kind of the tactic that the government was using. But also, I think the budget seemed so nice because the Chancellor has made announcements before this budget of the main nasty things that he's planning to do. So the increase in national insurance announced, I think it's just over a month ago. You had the cut to universal credit announced quite a long time ago. So he didn't necessarily have to repeat those things at the dispatch box, and he could paint quite a positive picture of what the government's plans were. Mm. The reorganisation of how alcohol duties are actually charged, I think they've changed it, because before it was quite a messy system, to be fair. There's different rates for different types of alcohol, but now they're saying that the stronger the drink, the higher the rate. So as someone who's a bit of a whiskey drinker, that is quite painful for me to hear. You know, not everybody who's an alcohol drinker will be benefiting from that either. Although I think they've expanded small brewers relief, which is quite interesting. So for small breweries, they will have a lower tax rate to be paying on the alcohol which they sell, but that isn't necessarily going to benefit everyone. And like I say, the actual benefits of that cut, that rate cut, won't necessarily be handed to consumers. So the kind of painting it as a, oh, we're going to revitalize the pub sector and hospitality, I don't necessarily see that happening.
Yeah, I don't see it happening either. I think it's also curious to look at this time last year, where we were thinking maybe Rishi Sunak might be the next prime minister, or that he might challenge Boris, or there might be some internal drama or something going on there. I don't really think it's the case anymore. I don't think Rishi Sunak has had the best year. And I didn't think it was a budget written by somebody who wanted to become the next prime minister. I think it very much was a number 10 and a number 11 budget, some parts of it quite stagnant, and nothing to run on a leadership campaign with is what I really thought. And I think there might be a lot of Tory backbenchers who weren't that impressed with the budget. And certainly watching some of the coverage from typical right-wing media sources or from Conservatives, I don't think it was that highly praised. And I think a lot of people are saying it's a Labour budget, it's a Gordon Brown budget. It's not. It's not even close to one of those. But it's not particularly a fiscally conservative budget either. And it might, as I said earlier, it might have to be completely written within 6 months if we have a bad winter.
I think you mentioned Gordon Brown and his style of budgets. And actually, it's quite interesting that they, in this budget, have included £500 million for family support and to reopen family centres and kind of help in those early years of a child's life, which sounds awfully similar to Sure Start, which the government has decimated over the past 10 years. And I feel like this is, if nothing else, a catch-up budget. Almost, it's kind of trying to catch up for 10 years of lost opportunities, lost investment, but it's not radical enough for that for me. It's not a radical budget that's pumping money into infrastructure and into public services that I think we need now to recover from the pandemic. And it just feels like we're plodding along and hoping for the best rather than actually taking radical ideas and pushing them.
Yeah, and I mean, that's exactly the same with like the education stuff. So taking the spending back to 2010, it's like, okay, it's just like you can't ignore everything that you've done after that point. You've cut everything and made the situation so much worse. We shouldn't be going back to 2010 because that's such a massive step back on top of everything that they've already cut.
Yeah, I think it was interesting that there was no real plan for climate, but you mentioned the cuts to taxes on short-haul flights, really domestic flights. And there was nothing in there that suggested to me that ahead of COP26, the government was actually taking the climate crisis seriously. Like, there's nothing that stood out, and I was like, yes, actually, they're being serious on this issue, and they know how huge it is, and they're kind of turning away from their traditional party donors who might have a reason to not be entirely enthralled in trying to save us against the climate crisis, and that they're going to turn to the public and say, actually, we care about your future. And I didn't really get that from the budget at all. And it just contrasted so much with what Rachel Reeves was saying at a Labour conference when we promised the huge spending on greening the economy. And there wasn't an equivalent of that in the Chancellor's budget at all.
Mm. Yeah, I agree with that. But then I also think on the flip side, maybe I think there's a lot of people calling for a 2022-23 election. I think with that budget, it's unlikely. So I don't think there was that much for the average bloke or a swing voter. And I think often, you know, I think personally, I think it will be 23-24 at the earliest. But that for me was an indication that they're not looking to call an election anytime soon. And they're very much, this is very much now a mid-government. We're very much within the parliamentary cycle. We're very much in the middle of it now. And we're going through to the, we're not even close to the final stages. We are slap bang in the middle of this government. So I think all the talk of an early, you know, quick 22 election, I think has gone out the window with this budget. And I'll be interested to see how the Treasury reacts closer and closer to 2024. And we'll see how their behaviour changes.
I think some of the messaging from this budget that the government has been putting out to the media has been really, well, their approach has been really unusual in that they announced most of their policies through leaks rather than kind of announcing them all on the day of the budget, which I believe Lindsay Hoyle was not a fan of and accidentally called for Rishi Sunak to resign, which was quite interesting watching the clip back. Yeah, it was kind of a passing comment, but he said, I think one of the backbenchers yelled out resign, and he was like, yeah, maybe you should resign. Basically, I'll see if I can find the clip to stick underneath the episode, because it did shock me. But yeah, the whole kind of messaging around it's really empty. Like, all the promises are quite empty because they're so marred in spin. So, for example, the Chancellor announcing £7 billion for transport outside London over the next year. Well, actually, when he was questioned about it by, I can't remember who, but he was questioned by someone about it, it turned out to be about £1.5 billion on top of what had already been announced. So it wasn't really a new announcement. It was just tweaking the figures and changing them here and there.
I think that's something the opposition should go harder on. Anyone who opposes the government, I think, should make more of a meal when it's actually not what they said. It's just an additional to the thing that they previously promised. Because I could say to you, like, oh, I'll lend you a tenner. And then the week after, I say, no, I'll lend you 20 quid. And 20 quid is different from the tenner that I already said I was going to lend you and another tenner. It's a different way of calculating that. And it's you. Well, you're not actually, you're just lending me a tenner on top of what you already said you were going to do. And I think if I was in Lotto, I would make more of a meal on what the Conservatives say is a promise and what they say and what their intentions are, because it just seems like they snowball to get bigger and bigger numbers. And until we see delivery on those, it's, I think one of the famous ones that comes to me is like the 50,000, was it doctors and nurses in 2019? And it was like, well, no, actually, or the 40 new hospitals, something like that. It was like, no, it's going to be 40 parts of hospitals that are going to be added on, 10 of which or so already exist and have already opened. So it's actually, it's not what you say. It's actually, you have to kind of break down on what they're actually saying.
It's interesting that you mentioned the NHS just very quickly. He mentioned in the budget that there's going to be £6 billion in spending for the NHS, but he didn't set any timing for that. So it could be 6 billion next year. It could be 6 billion next week, but more likely it's going to be, there's going to be an indefinite timeline on that, which you can pull up at any point in the future and say, well, actually, we did say that we were going to increase this funding, but by that point, in real terms, it might not make that much of a difference. It's really makes me more cynical about politics when a budget like this happens, because it's so easily picked apart. And you think, does the Chancellor think that the general public or even politicos are that naive and that stupid that they won't look into these things and just be like, yeah, sure, brilliant, fantastic
news?
No,
I don't think that's fair. I think they just look at they think most people will look at the top numbers, which they will, and they think at the end of the day, what's Laura Kunzberg going to say on the 6 o'clock news? And she's going to say the line from the government, which is, you know, the Conservatives have promised, insert figure here, and your average Joe Bloggs at home will think, well, that seems like a big number. You know, that's it, a billion, that seems like a lot of money, because it is to an individual, it is to a government, not necessarily. So I think that's what they should do, but the opposition should make more of a meal of the fact that they're just not telling the full truth and they're spinning it quite heavily. And I think the best way to do that is to spell out exactly what Labour would do, what we would do instead, and what that actually means for people. Because it's out, you can kind of pull numbers out of thin air. Classic reference, obviously to the thick of it, which is like, oh, we'll announce this. Well, we've got 10 million spent on that. And that sounds like a lot, doesn't it? And actually, you know, for the average person, it does sound like a lot, but it's a very funny part of the thick of it where they go through and just assign random things that sound good. And they sign budgets that just sound solid, like 1, 2, you know, 3 million, however, like, you know, just it sounds good. But I think the opposition now has to step up a little bit more and go in a little bit more with that. I also thought at the end of the day, it's not changing what people think of Boris. It's not changing what people think of the party or how the government's going. And it didn't really change what people thought of the opposition either. So we're behind in the polls and there seems to be no attack front. There seems to be absolutely no kind of, I don't know, I was kind of expecting more from the opposition to come back on that, because there was some quite easy points to get at, that some of which actually the three of us have highlighted here. And it, you know, you should always expect after a bad budget for the government's numbers to go down, but I don't think next week they will.
I think as well, if I can just come in on that numbers thing we were talking about before, the general public don't, and this is not to kind of criticise them, they're not going to understand the difference between 60 million and 60 billion. Obviously, they know it's more, but to a government, no one really understands what that means. So they can throw figures around like, oh, you know, we're going to commit 180 million on this. And people are like, wow, that's a lot of money. But actually, the actual figure they might need to commit is like triple that, or maybe even 10 times that. But people don't get that. I think it's so easy to just throw random huge numbers around like this. People don't understand, and you can say, oh, we're committing this much and it's a really big commitment from us, when actually it's not, because people just don't understand what these numbers actually mean, and they take advantage of that.
Amy, you've been very busy recently. You've been working on a pamphlet as part of your role as chair of the Young Fabians Education Network. Would you like to tell us a little bit about what we can expect from that pamphlet when it's published?
Yes, so the pamphlet is from their education network for the Young Fabians. So it's called Towards a 21st Century Curriculum. And it's all about, broadly, it's about curriculum reform, but it's about how sort of the specific changes we can make to kind of modernise our curriculum and actually prepare people for life and work kind of in our society. So it kind of originated from a sort of huge, quite obvious omissions in our curriculum. So from kind of Black history to personal financial education. You know, I don't know about you guys, but I don't really know that much about taxes and pensions. And it's quite important stuff. And it's just, there are certain assumptions that kind of underpin our curriculum. Like, you know, you'll get taught it at home, your parents will teach you about it. And that's really not the case. There's a lot of adults that don't understand how it works. So, you know, unless it kind of comes in as a compulsory thing that everyone understands, they can't make informed decisions. It's kind of no wonder that people are losing their pensions now you can access it a little bit earlier, because they don't understand, and it's not their fault they don't understand. No one is ever kind of explaining it to them. And, you know, perhaps there's a cynical reason behind that. I hope there isn't, but there might be. So it's just, there are a lot of assumptions that kind of underpin our curriculum that are just really outdated and don't kind of reflect what real life is like. So yeah, there's so many chapters. Originally I was a little bit worried, but we had like so many contributions. I think it's quite a broad topic, and it allows kind of people to draw upon their own education and what they wish they were taught. So we've got everything from like careers advice, got relationship and sex education. So it's really, really broad. So I'd encourage everyone, if you can, read it online. There's going to be like a small print run as well. So if you can get your hands on a copy, definitely do. It's going to be glossy and beautiful. But yeah, we've got our launch event on the 18th of November. We're not sure if we're going to have it in print by then, but we're definitely going to have like the online kind of version ready. But yeah, we're going to hopefully distribute it to the Shadow Education team. It's on the face of it, it seems like we're asking teachers to teach a lot more and students to digest a lot more. And obviously they've already got a really overloaded syllabus for their exams. That's not what we're trying to do. A lot of it is kind of reprioritizing what they already taught. So it's kind of taking things out and swapping things in. It's not necessarily just adding a bunch of stuff. Obviously some of it is kind of new additions, but it's not to kind of introduce them all at once necessarily. It can be done like over a period of time. And it's more of like a suggestion of, these are the range of things that we feel we should be taught about and we're not right now. Can you consider them, essentially?
The lack of kind of a curriculum for life is reflective of the fact that nowadays schooling has turned towards trying to hit targets. And there's a lot of the core subjects are what schools focus on at the expense of life skills and what was citizenship. Whether I don't know whether they actually still do citizenship, because actually they cut it at my school half the way through being there. But I do think it's reflective of the fact that kind of life skills are more difficult to grade, and that doesn't fit into the current framework which the government assesses schooling by, which I think is wrong. I think you should actually be tested on life skills, and that there should be a framework in place that you can see children's progress in learning about life skills, not necessarily to get a grade at the end of it and to say, wow, you've got a you've got a B or a D in life skills, but to kind of say, well, you've actually made this much progress whilst being at school to learn about things which are important to you, your everyday life. And I don't understand why the government doesn't want to prioritise that as part of the education curriculum, because it will make for a well-rounded country.
Yeah, I mean, one of the pieces is actually on kind of reforming assessments and how essentially now you're not learning to actually understand, you're literally learning to memorise for an exam, and how having like a broader range of assessments actually gives you more kind of life skills like communication and teamwork, which are what employers are actually saying that they want more young people to have. So it's a lot of it is just logical.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely fascinating. Definitely something I'll give a read to. Education's so interesting, because I'm sure education policy, and I'm sure you found this pamphlet to be fascinating, because everyone's had some level of education and everyone has an opinion on that level of education that they got or what they think they should have got, or in comparison to people that they know. Yeah, I mean, I think Brandon was right. We definitely live in an exam-based system, and that's not particularly helpful, because when you leave formal education, life isn't really in exams anymore, and you have to adapt to the fact that it's a lifelong learning process, and you don't just do it to pass a test, to pass a test, to pass a test. Often you have to go through life and take on challenges and grow. Good, it's something you could speak all day about, isn't it, really? But I always think in a like a really funny way, those memes I always used to see when I was younger, which was, you know, another day where I didn't, was it something like another day where I didn't use Pythagoras theorem? Like, so just funny things like that, where it's like math things that you learn at the time that have no relevance to your real life. And I don't blame the teachers teaching them, but we have to look into the future and say, okay, the workforce of tomorrow, people that are currently in their teens who in 10 years time will be entering the workplace formally as people in their early to mid 20s, what world are they going to live in, and what will be expected of them to work, and how can we prepare? And obviously, you know, you can't predict the future, but you can see trends, and you can say, okay, there's going to be a shortage of, for example, engineers, there's going to be a shortage of people with, you know, like skills to deal with people. Our economy is very service-based, so we'll have to train people to go into that. It probably won't change. The odds of Britain going back to a huge manufacturing economy, you know, those days are over. And I question whether our current curriculum is able to do that. And I think anything that a future Labour government can do to equip young people with the skills that they'll actually need in the workforce and will need, and whether that's something so simple as, you know, learning how to eat properly, how do you feed yourself when you're on your own, learning how to have a really simple routine and a schedule, learning like how you can help your mental health, or what you can do to make yourself feel better or worse, and who to contact when you do or don't feel like that. You know, really simple things which are not necessarily talked about. How to manage your money, I think, is Amy said that earlier, like absolutely fascinating. I don't think you can teach everything, but I think you can definitely put ideas in people's minds and thoughts about what is important in separate stages of your life and what isn't important. I think understanding housing, I think would have been really, I wish I'd learned a little bit. I wish if I could go back in time to 15-year-old me, or 13-year-old me, I'd say like, please learn about housing. Like, please understand like why this is important and why, because you'll have to live somewhere for the rest of your life and you're not taught about it, but it is really important. And then I think I'd also talk to myself or try and explain like the importance of nutrition and like how important it is that you know, you've got one body, you've got one engine, it's very difficult to change it, but you'll have it for the rest of your life, and how to equip yourself to put yourself in the best situation to be successful.
I definitely think that education should move more towards skills-based learning rather than content and knowledge-based learning, that's in inverted commas, because at the moment there's a real emphasis on retaining information rather than kind of the skills involved in that information originally being found, if you know what I mean. So just looking at history, I think the emphasis needs to move from retaining dates and information and events to kind of analysing primary sources. Where does the information come from? Especially, and we mentioned this last week, the kind of fake news age, actually questioning where sources of information come from. Who's it written by? What perspective are they written in? That's so much more important to a young person's development than necessarily just retaining the information initially. And that's coming from somebody who does like the events, the dates, the names. But I do think the emphasis should move more to the skills element of learning rather than, I mean, learning information does start to give you some of those skills in problem solving and in writing and reading. But there's more that could be done to place an emphasis on that, I think, than just trying to get kids to learn as much information as possible.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think mainly because of what we're taught, which is one of the articles in the pamphlet around sort of what we're taught in history. I think because of what we're taught, it's so like detached from where we are now, like the Tudors. It doesn't really affect our lives right now. If we also kind of covered more recent stuff that actually does impact our lives, like the war on terror, Iraq, people kind of shy away from it because it's quite contentious, but history is contentious. There was no part of history that wasn't contentious. So I think it's important to teach people about that, and that actually has an impact on their life. So I think content does have place, like you said, but I think it needs to be a mix of like content and skills, because I think understanding the content in terms of more recent stuff will help people understand what is going on now. Whereas when people kind of see Iraq or Afghanistan or any kind of real current event, they might kind of just switch off because they don't kind of understand the historical context of it because they were never taught it. So I think that's kind of important, but also definitely like the skills kind of questioning, is this actual fact or is this just what people have said? Like, I mean, there's that really famous thing about obviously Christopher Columbus kind of founding America, which is obviously not true, but it's like accepted fact. So it's like, there should be a lot more of kind of questioning what is accepted truth and what have people just kind of passed down. So I think that was just one of the other articles, I think, that was around sort of misinformation and actually questioning what you're reading and finding like multiple sources of information.
I think our generation, I say our generation, I mean anyone who's in their 20s or late teens at the minute is what I classify as a generation. I think our generation's ability to sort what is true and what is fake news or what is misinformation or what is a bias, what is very biased reading from an objective or as close as possible to the truth will actually dictate a huge amount about our lives, who we are as people, what happens in our lives, what happens politically, what happens socially, what happens economically. It's something that people don't talk about, but I actually think the ability of our generation to do that is very, very crucial. And I think it will be one of the big tests of our era is, can we, when flooded with information that's not true, are we able to ignore what isn't and focus on what is and act around the facts that you know to be true and adapt your behaviour and your life around that?
Yep. So when the pamphlet does come out, we will share it on the Left Wingers Twitter page. And yeah, I really look forward to reading it. I think it's going to be ace.
So speaking of disinformation and media bias, everyone's favorite tech billionaire Mark Zuckerberg had a big announcement for us this week. Big news at Facebook this week. after 6 months of quite challenging branding and PR issues, ranging from Mark Zuckerberg going to Congress to Facebook, WhatsApp and Instagram being down for almost a day, Mark has come up with a new and interesting way for us to work into the future. And he's renamed the holding company that owns Facebook, WhatsApp and Instagram to Meta, which is a kind of Silicon Valley word for artificial and online and virtual. I kind of said we should speak about this on the podcast because I think we're the ones, people that listen to this, probably the key consumers of Meta. So I thought we could have a little chat about it.
Yeah, so in the episode description and on Twitter, we will post a video of Mark Zuckerberg's virtual conversation with Nick Clegg, where they discuss, again, in quote marks, the metaverse, which I am, is a concept that I am still confused with, having watched that video now 1.5 times. Just, I replayed the bit where it's talking about the metaverse to see if I could understand it. I'm not exactly sure who this video was made for. I'm not sure if it's meant to be almost going to the general public, as in saying, this is really cool and interesting and you should be on board with the metaverse, whatever that means, or whether that's kind of a message to stakeholders and to shareholders. I'm not really sure what the intended audience was, and I'm not really sure that they knew that either, because the kind of what was meant to be an informal chat between Mark Zuckerberg and Nick Clegg feels incredibly, painfully robotic, which it does make it funny. And to be honest, we're talking about it now, so maybe it's done the job that they needed to do. But there's a huge lack of self-awareness in both how the video is structured, the promotion video is structured, and also what they're discussing. So not only was the speech incredibly wooden, what they were talking about, people knowing what's happening with their data and ensuring that users are safe, which, considering what Facebook has been in the news for the past year, seems rather hypocritical and a bit ironic. What have you got to say about this? I really don't know how I feel about it.
Is the point of it to just distract us and confuse us and then forget that they have all our information? Because if that is the purpose, I don't really think it's going to work, because we were already confused about what they have about us and what they do with that information. Calling it a new name, the metaverse, is not going to change that. It's going to make us more confused and more suspicious about what's going on.
I actually disagree with that. It was a combination of a defensive and an offensive move by Mark Zuckerberg, who I think, for all his flaws, and he has many, is probably the best predictor of human behaviour, probably in the world. And I think one of the reasons why Facebook has done so well, and then the acquiring of WhatsApp was so useful, and the acquisition of Instagram, all of which were done in the past 5 or 6 years, I think both of those have completely played into his advantage. And the reason why is because he understands human behaviour more than everyone else does. And I think it's that ability that he has that has made him so incredibly successful. It's a shame that he is so robotic, and I'd imagine he might have taken, you know, hundreds of hours of media training, and where somebody has tried to get him in a room and say, like, you know, things originally, like, we're all having a conversation now where we're speaking authentically, and he is unable to do that, which is a shame. But I do think this is the next, while it's not here right now, in the next 20 or 30 years, I think that's the way we're going, where everything will be virtual. For example, we're recording this podcast, we're having a good time, but it's all virtual. We're not in the same place recording this podcast, and an online universe where you can get out of bed, put on your, what I'm sure will be glasses or goggles or whatever he comes up with, whatever AI thing we'll have at the time, and we'll log on to work and we'll work in a virtual office, or we'll have virtual social events, or, you know, whatever it might be. I don't necessarily think the real life will go out of the window, but I think this is the beginning of virtualization of work, social life, money, everything. And he's trying to set himself up and his brand and company up for that. It's also a nice little thing that will boost profits and, you know, Facebook haven't had the best year. Several scandals, quite rightly. A whistleblower that said some quite, you know, tough things, which I think are probably true. And then obviously a shortage a couple of weeks back when we all didn't have Facebook for 6 hours and had to speak to each other. And that was, you know, quite challenging for some people and quite enjoyable for others. And this is it. This is the next big thing. And he wants to be a market leader in what he sees as the next big thing, which is the virtual world in which we all will be living in.
I will never kind of, I'm always a bit of a skeptic of people who have really, I'm always skeptical of people who have big, crazy ideas about what the future entails, particularly people who've already had success, because once upon a time, they made the decisions and the predictions that meant they become successful now. I don't necessarily always think that they have the best ability to predict, weirdly enough, because they've already had that success and then they kind of have a confidence about what they feel the future is going to look like. And I don't necessarily think that's always the case. In terms of Mark Zuckerberg himself, I do think he needs a little bit more media training. I'm sure, as you say, that he's had a lot. I agree with you. He seems to be very good at predicting what people want. And he seems to know an awful lot about how to grow the company of Facebook and now Meta, to kind of face the new challenges that the world brings. I do feel confident that this is going to be a success, but I'm not sure that the branding of it is completely the correct way to go about it. I don't know. I'm incredibly confused by the whole thing, so that probably coming off in how I'm talking about it.
it's not Facebook, it's the company, it's the holding company that owns Facebook, WhatsApp, Instagram, and several other things that we don't know about. What I thought was interesting when I was thinking about this podcast today was the fact that within the first hour of me getting up, of me like getting out of bed this morning, I had used three out the first, like, the three things I went on my phone to do: WhatsApp, Instagram, WhatsApp, emails, Instagram, and Facebook, and obviously Google, you know, Gmail. But apart from that, the other three were Mark Zuckerberg owned, were Facebook owned, Meta owned products. And then I thought, actually, how much of my communication online as a person is made up by those three apps? And I would say 90%, maybe 80%. Maybe work emails come into a little bit, which are, you know, which is Microsoft, and, you know, another billionaire owns that. But it's like absolutely fascinating how one man and his company has basically taken over how I completely communicate. I'd be absolutely fascinating to see what he comes out with. I think this is the next, his kind of setup for the next kind of AI world in which we began to enter with working from home, with digital meetings, with Zoom, and we're probably now going to continue on with the rest of, you know, artificial AI, for example, NFTs, altcoins, things like that. It's just like, I feel like they're just getting started. It's just the beginning, and he wants to capitalize on that quite quickly.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think the pandemic has definitely marked like a huge shift that will impact us kind of forever. We don't need to be in the same room anymore. We can do exactly what we did before. It'd be like halfway around the world. I think part of it as well is, it reflects that people, I don't know why, I mean, I probably am sort of in this group as well, who trust WhatsApp more than they trust Facebook. I think especially because Facebook have been much more on the news in terms of like going to Congress, sharing data, a lot of stuff to do with political campaigning as well. The way that they use information that we didn't realize they use our information in that way before. Whereas WhatsApp, whenever we kind of mention it on the news, it's sort of like, people, we want to access their messages, but we can't because they're so encrypted. So it's like two completely different sides of the coin to me. And I think him rebranding the overarching company into this thing that's new and doesn't have the same connotations and reputation that Facebook does is trying to move away from it. But to be honest, I think as long as Mark Zuckerberg is attached to it, it's not going to, I'm skeptical about the extent to which they're going to be able to move away from that reputation.
I'd also like to add a comment, which is Nick Clegg, how the mighty have fallen. What a thing he was 10 years ago. Do we all remember the I agree with Nick debates where he was like the darling of the political world?
Actually, I would say that I think he's fallen quite firmly on both of his feet. Like, it always impresses me how people can drop out of British politics and land in, it's just the way that it is. They land in big, big company jobs, and they're important for a whole different other reason without the kind of reputation of their political life. Like, I just find it fascinating how you can just transition from one world to the other, and everybody's got to kind of go, yes, this is normal. this is a normal transition for somebody to make from the world of British politics to the
media.
Yeah, it normally happens with banks, but kind of moving to international companies, like, it's such a weird transition that we've just kind of accepted, yes, this is normal for people to make. And it seems so odd, just the fact that he definitely has had a conversation with Mark Zuckerberg, not in the form that it's shown in the video, but he definitely has had that conversation. And they just seem like two different worlds in my head. And I can't quite put them together, which is why watching the promotional video, I think, makes me so uncomfortable.
Just before we come to Amy, we have a little announcement to make. Contrary to popular opinion and what I've been messaged about several times today, no, our very own Brandon is not the Brandon in the popular meme, song, and now political slogan, Let's Go Brandon.
Yeah, I came to this recording feeling very confused by seeing the words Let's Go Brandon trending on Twitter. And especially because when I clicked on the hashtag to see what it was all about, it was just a lot of right-wing American political commentators using the term MAGA hats, but with Let's Go Brandon on the front of them. And it's just a whole different meme world that I am clearly not clued into. It confused me immensely when I saw it on my Twitter feed. I was like, what? My name? Why am I going? Where am I going? What am I doing? And yeah, I turned to Kathleen, to Amy, to George, who sat behind Amy on this recording, and asked them to inform me what Let's Go Brandon means. Kathleen, have you worked it out? Could you tell me?
Right, so basically, this is what I've gathered from about 15 minutes of intense Googling. There was a NASCAR driver who said something bad about Joe Biden, which is explicit, about the Biden administration. And then a hat was worn with the driver's name, who I think was called Brandon, which instead of saying Joe Biden, would say, Let's go Brandon, which is a support of somebody who doesn't like Joe Biden. And then there has now been a song that has been released into the charts called Let's Go Brandon by some rapper, I believe, or some kind of, I don't know. It's not music I listen to be fair, and the lyrics aren't great, which is a summary of Biden's failures in the last year and a half, should we say, and maybe pushes right-wing lines, but I think now has got into the American public stream of consciousness, which I think is an apt point to say, we know that some of our listeners are in America, so if you're one of our American listeners and would like to come on to talk about Let's Go Brandon with our very own Brandon, not the Brandon that,
don't tie
that
me
this
with
is referring
this.
Don't,
to. Don't put us next
another
to
another Brandon. Well, there could be more than one Brandon. You could be, you're the best Brandon.
Thank you.
This is another Brandon. Kathy. So if you want to talk about Let's Go Brandon, the NASCAR driver, to Let's Go Brandon of the Left Wingers, please get in touch with us, because we'd love to talk to you.
If you'd like to keep in touch with us, you can follow us on Instagram, Twitter, or like us on Facebook. Also, don't forget to tell other people about us. It's the main way that we grow our podcast. And once again, thank you, Amy, for coming on. It's been great to talk to you, and we look forward to sharing your pamphlet when it has arrived.
Keep whinging, and we'll see you next week.